part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, presenting Beauty and the Beast from Wednesday, July 6th through Sunday, July 17th. Nominated for 9 Tony Awards, Beauty and the Beast is based on the Disney Academy Award-winning animated feature film. Ticket information is available at 1-888-261-9675.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer and social commentator James Howard Kunstler says the days of cheap energy are numbered, and as the end approaches, we're in for epical change. Kunstler is the author of the new book, The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. Kunstler says this long emergency will change everything. We will downscale big time. Globalism will come to a screeching halt, and our focus will become local. Are we ready to tackle the great changes that lie ahead? No, says Kunstler. We are sleepwalking into the future. What about alternatives to oil and natural gas, you ask? Kunstler responds, that's a fantasy. We'll hear more about Kunstler's vision of the future this afternoon as he is our guest in this portion of the program. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for James Howard Kunstler. You can join the discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. James Howard Kunstler is the author of 4 books of nonfiction, including The Geography of Nowhere. He's also the author of 9 novels. He's been an editor at Rolling Stone, and his articles have appeared in The Atlantic Monthly and The New York Times Magazine. James Howard Kunstler's book, The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century, is published by The Atlantic Monthly Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Jim Kunstler, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Well, it's nice to be here with you, Celeste.
You write in this book, the key to understanding what is about to happen to us is contained in the concept of the global oil production peak. What is it? What's contained in that concept?
The global oil production peak.
Right.
Yeah, peak oil for short. The point at which that the world will never produce any more oil in a given year. And afterwards, the production will decline remorselessly by several percentage points a year. It will change everything. And the idea is often commonly misunderstood by the public. We don't have to run out of oil to start having serious problems with the complex systems that we depend on. Everything from the interstate highway system to the 12,000-mile merchandise supply lines to Walmart to industrial agriculture. These things are going to be in big trouble.
Yeah. Is it possible that we've seen the global oil production peak?
There seems to be a consensus of opinion forming that we may actually have entered that period. And they describe it as kind of a, not so much as a peak, as a bumpy plateau, because things are going to kind of wobble for a while. The oil markets will wobble. It will not be clear. And indeed, right now, it is not quite clear, for example, whether Saudi Arabia really has the potential to increase its production. We've asked them about 11 times to do that in the last 18 months, and they have failed to do it consistently. And so the opinion is beginning to grow among geologists that they may actually not be capable of increasing their production and may, in fact, have been fudging their reserve statistics for many, many years. The Saudi Arabian National Oil Company, Aramco, is, of course, a state-owned, nationalized company, and it's not transparent. They don't have to report to shareholders, and their numbers are state secrets. So the markets are telling us that perhaps nobody in the world can increase production anymore, meaning we're at peak.
Yeah. Geologists, economists, oil companies, are they worried?
I think a lot of people are concerned about what we face, and it's really terra incognita, an unknown frontier. It's been 200 years since we entered the fossil fuel phase of civilization, the exuberant industrial age. I think we're beginning to get a sense now that it's not just a permanent condition, but it's kind of a story that had a beginning, a middle, and perhaps leading to an end. And we don't know what that's going to bring. There's an awful lot of wishful thinking, people hoping and praying and wishing that, quote, alternative fuels will rescue us. But it's my position in the book, The Lung Emergency, that no combination of alternative fuels will allow us to run the interstate highway system in Disney World, or indeed the entire American system, the way we're accustomed to running it.
Hmm.
Or even a substantial fraction of it. And we are going to have to make other arrangements.
Hmm. We've got a listener in a car waiting to talk with us this afternoon. Fittingly enough, I suppose. A listener on line one. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I'm really happy to talk to you. I've read your work, and I've read maybe five or six different works in the last couple of years. But I think that's the key about it.
We lost her.
Yeah.
Canticle for Leibowitz?
Yes, I did read A Canticle for Leibowitz.
Yes.
In college, 30 years ago.
Right. And do you see it as being something along that line?
Let me explain to the listeners. The book A Canticle for Leibowitz, which was written by a sci-fi writer named Miller, Walter Miller, I think, came out in the 60s or 70s, 60s, and it's about it's a futuristic novel about a monk who is striving to kind of recollect the debris of civilization after it has wrecked itself in some manner. You know, I'm not a sci-fi writer, and I'm not a futurologist, and I'm not really predicting what's going to happen 1,000 years from now. It's hard enough hard enough to say what's going to happen in 10 years.
Right.
But I do think that we're going to be living profoundly and intensely more local lives. That, the far-flung relations that we enjoy today, economic relations and so on, are going to wither. And we're going to have to make other arrangements locally for doing things that are very important to us, like how we're going to feed ourselves, what kind of production methods we're going to use to make the things that we need. We will probably have far fewer things than we now enjoy.
Yes.
And what kind of occupations we're going to have. Things are going to change very, very much, I believe, in our lifetime.
Yes. Do you see maybe, I was just talking a couple weeks ago to someone about we should start having our own generators, and we will be maybe riding bikes sometimes in our houses to generate our own energy.
Well, having your own generator
yeah.
kind of assumes that you're going to have your own fuel supply or your own oil well, too.
Yeah.
I do think that we will probably see some kind of alternative energy systems used on a household basis and perhaps on a neighborhood or local basis. Things like wind and solar will lend themselves more to highly localized use than just plugging them into the electric grid.
Right.
And I think that that's what we'll see. But, it may generate a lot of envy and resentment from the people who don't have them. And one of the things we can't predict is what the social relations will be between the economic losers, and there will be a lot of them, and the people who continue to do okay. Or even what the proportions will be in the population, and, how they'll treat each other. We don't know.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm going to listen more. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, surviving the converging catastrophes of the 21st century. Is it possible that we'll see the discovery of new oil fields or ways in which to extract more oil from fields that are becoming depleted? And talk with us a little bit more about alternatives to oil and natural gas.
You know, the exploration of the known parts of the earth, the parts that are above water, has been actually very, very thorough. And in fact, there were no significant discoveries of new oil, really, in the calendar years 2002, 2003. I'm not sure the figures are in for 2004, but I think I saw some that said also no significant discoveries. And what we're discovering is that, what we're learning is that discovery itself peaked probably 30 years ago, and that if you don't discover oil, you can't find it. Now, Russia and China, because they were communist nations, went about relentlessly drilling and exploring for oil in their most far-flung provinces, because they didn't have to justify it economically to any, you know, board of directors or shareholders. They were a communist country. So they have been very thoroughly explored. Chances are they are not going to find more oil there. The indications are that we're not going to find that much more oil in the Middle East, and some of the discoveries we're making in North America, like what is presumed to be under Anwar in Alaska, are really insignificant in terms of global use. The technology for drilling has gotten a lot better, but you know what? The unintended consequence of that is that we've only found a more efficient way to deplete the existing oil well. So, you know, there are diminishing returns to that technology. And that is part of the problem with Saudi Arabia, is that the technology for drilling, including things like bottle brush drilling and horizontal drilling, got so much better in the last 20 years that their reserves were depleted a lot more quickly than expected. My guess is, and I've said this in my book, that if we want to keep the lights on after the year 2025, we may have to resort to a much more robust nuclear energy program. I say that with full recognition that it carries a lot of hazards with it, and that we have to take that very seriously, and that we ought to have a very serious national discussion about it, but we're not even beginning that. There are many other things we could do that we're not even doing. The task of restoring the national passenger rail system is of supreme importance to us. It would take tremendous pressure off of our oil use. Right now, it's impossible for people to take a train between places like Cleveland and Columbus, Ohio, you know. And there are many, many, many other places that you can't get to by train. The fact that we're not even talking about it, including, by the way, the Democratic Party, and I'm a registered Democrat, the fact that there's no discussion about it shows how unserious we are, and it is really unworthy of our political history to be so clueless. There probably isn't a single project in America that would do more to boost our self-confidence about facing these problems than rebuilding the passenger railroad system. It's technology we understand, and the right-of-ways are there, and we're doing nothing about it. So it shows you how unserious we are.
I want to take another call here in just a moment, but you said if we want to keep the lights on after 2025, it's coming that soon, you think?
Oh, actually, I think that we're in the zone already of the long emergency. We've really entered the zone when things are going to wobble and destabilize, and you know the oil markets themselves are clearly wobbling, with prices going up as much as 10%, in a given week as they did last week, and then back down, you know, another several percent this week, and we can expect a lot more of that, and what we're going to see are the complex systems we depend on, like big box shopping and the warehouse on wheels, which is our way of distributing the goods. All those things are going to start running into trouble, you know. You think that we're going to be able to run the warehouse on wheels when the independent truckers can't make their truck payments because they're paying so much for fuel? You know, we haven't begun to really feel the pain or express the kind of pain that we're beginning to undergo.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
I'm concerned about the petroleum situation, especially right now. during this hot weather, the city of Philo is having a water emergency because their antiquated pumping system can't keep up with demand. And I heard on the news last night trying to encourage people to conserve electricity. But right now, gasoline jumped to $2.35 a gallon just this last week. And at least here around Champaign-Urbana, it appears that they're doing absolutely nothing. We need to declare a petroleum emergency. I'd like to see a variation on the even-odd day, what I call even-odd toll days, on even-numbered days of the month. Cars with an even number, or in the case of license plates with letters, you assign an even and odd value to the particular letters, would have to pay. I'd like to see them have to pay at least a dollar to drive North Prospect to the shopping area. Traffic is so aggravating up there, and a lot of it is the discretionary so-called recreational shopping. And I would think if they had to pay on certain days, that would at least keep a fairly substantial portion of the traffic off the streets. In Campus Town, the situation has really gotten out of hand altogether. We do need to charge people a substantial amount to drive. We could have it, as some towns that had toll bridges across the rivers did. If you bought more than a certain amount at the store, you'd get your toll reimbursed. But we need that would still might, that would, of course, force people to buy when they did do some browsing shopping. But we've just got a terrible problem. It seems like the students are taking practically an ostrich head in the sand approach, and their parents are not disciplining them about the need to conserve energy. It seems like they're just burning it up, driving willy-nilly between bars and so forth. The rush hour traffic's out of hand. The bus service is woefully inadequate, and annexing new subdivisions will not solve the problem. We need to get the mass transit off the property tax and have some kind of fee on vehicles, perhaps. As one book I used to have on the environment suggested, to do a formula based on your annual mileage for an impact fee.
You're putting me to sleep here.
That's a list. Let me ask our guest, Jim Counselor, to respond.
Well, the gentleman is suggesting we ought to declare a petroleum emergency. There's a reason why that's not happening. You know, aside from the attack of 9/11, which is now 4 years ago, we're really not facing any kind of obvious precipitating crisis other than the price of a barrel of oil going remorselessly up. Right now, we're in a kind of a slow hemorrhaging process. You know, it's kind of the death of a thousand cuts. I think sooner or later, the public may face some restrictions. One of the problems is that we're even more of a car-dependent culture now than we were 30 years ago when the first OPEC oil crisis happened. And we're traveling far more miles, much greater distances, much larger percentage of the population actually living in suburbia. And the prospect is that the suburban life simply isn't going to work the way we're accustomed to having it work. And it's going to be a great shock to the public to discover this.
Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hi. You indicated that we needed a rail system. Is it your understanding that rail is cheaper to transport people than an airplane is?
Well, I think there's no question that rail makes a lot more sense for certain kinds of trips, and mainly for cities and towns that are, several hundred miles apart. When it's all said and done, the amount of time that you have to show up at the airport early and wait around for delayed flights, you're talking about a 4 or 5 hour expenditure of time, and forget about the money, to take what might otherwise be a 3 hour rail trip, with a lot less aggravation. And also we would, the airports would become significantly less congested if they didn't have to run so many flights between cities that would be better served by rail. I think you can say that rail is far more economical for carrying people around. On the whole, though, I wouldn't get necessarily bogged down in an argument based on statistical analysis. Statistical analysis is what has given us the interstate highway system and extreme car dependency and parking lots that are only full on the day after Thanksgiving.
Does the caller want to follow up? No, I guess he's gone. Let's invite others to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with a telephone call. Questions, comments, invited. 333-9455. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. At the outset of this book, you say you regard suburban living as deeply pernicious. And while you think we'd be better off living differently, you don't welcome the tremendous hardship that you see on the horizon with the end of suburbia. Would you talk with us a bit about your view of suburban living and the change you see on the horizon?
Well, we made a kind of collective decision in the 20th century to build ourselves a drive-in utopia. I can understand, it's easy to understand why we would want to build this sci-fi world that had never been seen before, that seemed to promise limitless comfort and luxury and the amenities of being close to nature. Of course, it didn't turn out that way. There were a lot of diminishing returns. Suburbia, in many respects, ended up being a cartoon of life in the country, in a cartoon of a country house. And that's one of the reasons why it ended up being subject to ridicule, even by the people who live in it. One way of describing the suburban project, which I favor, is to look at it as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. And that has certain tragic overtones. What it means is we really invested our national wealth in an infrastructure for daily life that has very poor prospects for the future. And it raises additional questions that ought to be very troubling. For one, this phenomenon that I call the psychology of previous investment. And that's a fancy way of saying that we've put so much of our wealth into this system of car dependency and all the parts of it, the suburban subdivisions, the strip malls, the parking lots, the centralized schools with their fleets of yellow buses that travel thousands and thousands of miles every week. We put so much of our wealth into this that we can't imagine changing it or reforming it or letting go of it. And so there's going to be a tremendous effort to sustain the unsustainable in the years ahead. And that's going to lead not only to economic hardship, but to a lot of political mischief. Because people, Americans, will be very, very reluctant to give up their entitlement to the American dream way of life. And they will fight to keep it going no matter what message is coming from the world telling them that they really have to change, that history is compelling them to live differently. Mm-hmm. And this fight may actually, this struggle may lead to the election of political extremists, as Americans turn to people who promise to turn the clock back to 1997. I think it will lead to a lot of regional friction. And I think we're in for a rough ride with this. And, you know, economically and financially, the failure of suburbia, just as a practical living arrangement, and it will fail, will represent a tremendous loss of presumed wealth.
Let's talk with some more listeners. Next, we go to Effingham, a listener on line one. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I'm a conservative Republican, so, yeah, like the rails. There used to be a rail to St. Louis, and you could take a ball game or something like that, but you can't do that anymore. And just like you say, we're covering up our prime farm ground, putting houses on that after you lay it with concrete, you know, you'll never really be able to reform it again. So
this is a very, very important part of the picture.
I just think we're selling our family estate for just a night out of town, and I'm like you, within 50 years or so, I think we're really going to be paying for it.
It is vitally important that we stop the suburban development right now. You know, anything we do now is going to be tragic. Because we are going to need this farmland. We are going to have to reorganize agriculture. The Pepsi-Cola, Cheese Doodle, Cargill, Archer Daniel Midland model of agriculture, of just pouring natural gas inputs and petroleum inputs in the soil to produce massive amounts of corn, this is going to fail. And we are going to have to grow much more of our food close to home.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's go next to a listener in Danville on line four. Hi.
Yes. Years ago, they were saying about the shortage of oil, and we cut back on our fuel use and use better efficient cars, and put amongst other things. And they said in so many years we'd be out of fuel. Well, that time has passed. What happened? Someone forgot to carry a 2 in their math, or they, you know, didn't discover a lot more stuff. Oil and other resources are being made in nature more readily than what we thought there was. And since it was wrong back then, whatever you're saying is, well, you was wrong then. Why should I believe you now?
Well, this is a common misunderstanding among the public that the Earth has a creamy nougat center of oil, and that oil fields continue to replenish themselves automatically and naturally. It actually has not been demonstrated that this occurs anywhere in the world, and in particular in the oil fields that we know the best in America. Oil production in America was 11 million barrels a day in 1970, and it's under 5 million barrels of conventional crude today. We have about 28 billion barrels of conventional crude left in reserve, and we use 7 billion barrels a year. We are in trouble, and the Earth is not replenishing itself. People make the mistake of thinking that we got through the disorders of the 1970s, and that means that nothing can ever happen again. Well, the disorders of the 1970s were caused because America, the United States oil production, peaked, and the pricing power shifted to other people, namely OPEC. This time, we're heading for a global peak, and that is going to be different. That is not going to be a temporary oil crisis. It's not going to be a temporary geopolitical shifting of costs and pricing power. It is going to be a permanent energy predicament.
But we're using more oil now than we did then, and we haven't run out, and it's predicted to run out 30 years ago.
You know, the caller, let me follow up and kind of chime in here a little bit, because I imagine some of our listeners are recalling the oil crisis of the 70s, the OPEC embargo, and we remember the long lines. We remember gas prices going way up.
Yeah.
We saw a change in the speed limit. We saw changes in where we set thermostats. And now that's all gone.
Very traumatic.
And it's all gone. And, you know, so, you know.
We went back to sleep, Celeste.
Yeah.
We went back to sleep. And the fact is that what we're facing now is going to be worse than what we saw in the 1970s. And it is going to be permanent.
Yeah. I also imagine some of our listeners might be thinking about the predictions made in the 60s and 70s, like those of Paul Ehrlich, and earlier, a couple hundred years earlier, Thomas Malthus.
Well, neither of these guys have actually been disproved. The only thing that happened was that we had what was called the Green Revolution, which was we developed the ability to boost crop yields phenomenally and to produce a lot more crops to feed a lot more people around the world. But you know what? Almost all of the production increase was not due to, you know, genetic modification or better breeding. It was almost all entirely due to oil-based and natural gas-based fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, and irrigation. And that is what happened, and that was what is permitted the world to continue increasing population. You know, the predictions that were made for oil in the 1960s are actually still valid. Mr. Hubbert, who developed the model called Hubbert's Peak for understanding oil supplies and the geology of oil, Mr. Hubbert's prediction was that the United States would peak around 1970, and that's exactly what happened. He predicted that the world would peak somewhere between the late 90s and the early 2000s. That appears to be exactly what's happened on schedule. So there actually is no discrepancy between the long-standing predictions and models and exactly what's happening.
Let's talk with some more listeners. Next, we go to a caller in Indiana on line two. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Oh, it's delightful. I certainly appreciate talking with you.
Earful, not an eyeful.
As an observer, okay? I know little, but I observe, okay?
Yeah.
And I'm older, right? And so I've been upset with programs over the years, and then find, you know, they don't necessarily turn out to be as they're represented. And this oil thing has really got me fascinated. Because if I was in the oil business, what would be my psychology at this particular point? I'm hung up with the fact that the United States is a producer of oil and a seller of oil. And the Alaskan oil, it is said that I've read somewhere that it all goes to Japan. Oh, my Lord and God, I can see why some people would just love this spike in the price, because it helps our balance of trade. It also produces a lot of graft, a lot of pork. So this increase of the price of fossil fuel is an answer to somebody's prayer.
You know, I think that a lot of people would like to think that the problems that we're encountering with energy are due to business conspiracies or the manipulations of Arabs and other people, or you know, behind the scenes dealings and conspiracies. But I actually think it's a lot simpler than that. It really has to do with geology, and you know, we're bumping up against limits. Certainly, oil companies are enjoying hefty profits, but you know what? We can tell by their behavior what it means. They're not investing these tremendous profits in new exploration because they know there's very little left to discover. That what they're doing is buying back their own stock and you know, giving larger dividends to their shareholders. And because they know they're in an industry which is destined to contract and to do so fairly soon. And that's what you can tell about the oil companies. I tend to be allergic to conspiracy theories, but I do think that the energy problems we're facing are going to only aggravate the already existing high level of delusional thinking in America, especially the political delusions. And it will probably lead to a lot of blaming and finger-pointing and scapegoating. I think the American public really has themselves to blame for having made a series of tragic and unfortunate choices in their way they live, largely based on their unwillingness to give up extreme comfort and extreme convenience. There's going to be a price to be paid for that.
Let's talk with another listener. El Paso, Illinois, line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having the program. I have a couple of comments I'd like to make, and then I would like some time for the writer to give his where he could be reached via the internet. My first comment would be: I think the day will come, way off in the future, when humankind will curse the invention of the personal automobile. I think it's brought about so many changes, not all for the good, especially as you said, the decline of passenger rail service. Now, I'm not speaking about trucks. Trucks are needed to transport our commodities, but the personal automobile, there's so many large ones with one person in it going down the road. And I think the future may well lie within strip cities that are built between the larger metropolitan areas. For example, here between Chicago and St. Louis, along existing good rail lines, and to concentrate the development there and do that pattern throughout the country, and which would discourage development out in the rural areas with where the only means of transportation is the automobile. So I'd be interested in your comments and also, as I say, an address where you could be reached on your website. Thank you very much.
Yeah, my website is mylastname@.com, KUNSTLER.com. That's my website, and my email address is on it. There are many people have many ideas about how we may be reorganizing American life. I tend to think that the corridor idea is to some extent an extension of our fantasies about mobility. And in fact, I think that the future is going to be much more about staying where you are than being mobile all the time. I tend to think we're going to see a reversal of the trend of the last 150 years, that we're going to see significant contractions in our cities and much more movement back toward smaller towns, smaller cities, and places that have viable agriculture. There are implications for parts of our country that are kind of gloomy. You know, I don't think that Phoenix is going to work very well, or Tucson, in the lower energy future. I think the excitement will be over in Las Vegas. I think that we will be shocked at how much our largest cities and metroplexes will have to contract. Our biggest cities, like Chicago and New York City, particularly Manhattan Island, are overburdened with megastructures. And these large, large buildings and skyscrapers were really products of the fossil fuel age, and we cannot be confident that we can run them in a much more energy-restricted society. And I think they may prove to be enormous liabilities. So I think that we'll see very significant contractions of Chicago and New York. New York has additional problems being burdened with, and Chicago, these immense asteroid belts of suburban fabric that are probably not going to work very well and that may not be reusable for, you know, for as far ahead as we can see. There are some cities, especially in the Midwest, that are already in an advanced state of contraction and dereliction. I noticed in the news today that Detroit went off the list of the nation's 10 largest cities for the first time since 1900. St. Louis, Kansas City, Des Moines, Milwaukee, all of these cities, to some extent, are in a state of contraction. Cleveland. It is going to continue, and something will be in these places because they occupy important sites. But we're not going to reenact the 20th century, and these are not going to be the great industrial metropolises that they used to be. It remains to be seen how we will use them and how people will live in them. But, you know, St. Louis is where it is because it occupies a site where the Mississippi and the Missouri River converge. And so it's important geographically, geoeconomically, strategically. Something will be there. We don't know what.
Yeah, I'm going to take another call here in just a second, but before we do that, one of the things that was interesting to consider in your book is that we might return to the waterways as a way of travel and commerce.
Yeah, that's something that I think we have to take seriously, that, in the absence of diesel fuel, cheap diesel fuel and cheap gasoline, we may see a renaissance of, water transport in America, and the places that are along water routes, which have been long neglected and long overlooked, and the infrastructure long forgotten. You know, these places may revive again, and to a considerable extent, especially in the Great Lakes region. Mm. So, there are also implications for water power. Now, you're in the Midwest, and it's kind of flat in the Midwest. I'm in the Northeast, and we have a lot of decommissioned small hydro sites that produced hydroelectricity, but they were taken offline and allowed to just deteriorate because the big power companies didn't want to pay to maintain all the little sites. We're going to have to put those things back into production again.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line 3. Hi.
Good afternoon. Could you talk a little bit about what your vision is of the future of manufacturing, assuming we can't, buy what we need at Walmart or various other big box stores?
Yeah, it's a very troubling question. I think we're simply going to have less to buy. I think shopping in general will fade much more into the background of life. We are not going to be living in a nonstop blue light special shopping fiesta the way we have for the last generation or so. It remains to be seen how we will make things. A lot of the manufacturing infrastructure of the country is either in a state of dereliction or actually vanished. Where I live in the Northeast along the Hudson and Mohawk Rivers, there are whole towns in which the factories have actually been bulldozed, so they're not even there anymore to be reused if we even wanted to reuse them. And the chances are that we're not going to be able to manufacture on the scale that we enjoyed in the early 20th century because that was all based on the mourning of the oil era, when oil was very, very cheap and very plentiful, and there was no notion that we would ever run into limits with it. So the scale of that is not going to happen, I think, within view. It's possible that we may return to something more along the lines of cottage industries. You know, along with this, of course, there's the implication that we're going to have to rebuild vast networks of local economic interdependency in which people play local roles in all phases of commerce, including making things, wholesaling things, being jobbers and retailers. And these systems were destroyed by the big box retailers. And I would like to remind the listeners that the public was complicit in the destruction of their own communities. They welcomed the big box stores into their towns, no matter what kind of destruction they caused, because they wanted to save $4 and a hair dryer. Well, we now see what the consequences of that has been. It's been disastrous all over the country. Every main street in America now has got vacancy signs in the windows if the buildings are still there. We're going to need to put that stuff back together again, and it's going to be a very, very hard job.
Let's talk with another listener. Atlanta, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Hi. Thanks. I'm glad I get to talk to you. I read your article in Rolling Stone. And
that was a summary of the book, more or less.
Exactly. It's a summary of the book, and I'm going to get the book just as soon as I can get to town from suburbia and get one. No, I live on a I live on a farm, so that's not quite true. I noticed in that article that the main emphasis was on economics, and rightfully so. I just wonder what you think of throwing in the environmental impacts that are also looming just as, you know, much as the oil impacts are. If you add those together, what you think of the longest emergency then?
Well, we are facing environmental problems. We're not facing them. We've already got them. You know, the diminishing returns of an oil-based economy, pollution, cancer-causing chemicals present everywhere. But we're already living with those. Those are here. It's probably not going to change. In fact, the prospects are if we use smaller amounts of fossil fuel, as we incrementally will, that we may be discharging fewer things. Now, that said, obviously, you know, there are places in the world that produce much huger amounts of pollution. The pollution in China is orders of magnitude beyond anything we could imagine, as is the destruction to their various water systems, their rivers, their water tables and aquifers and so forth. The real environmental issue that's facing us, and something I cover in some detail in the book, of course, is climate change. I happen to believe that it doesn't necessarily matter anymore whether it was man-made or part of a natural cycle or a combination of the two, because I don't believe that we're ever going to do anything about it. I don't believe that any set of international protocols is going to be followed, and I think that's just the grim reality of it. Climate change is going to be upon us, may already be upon us, and we're going to have to deal with it. The main implication of it is how it will affect crop yields and food production. And, you know, the combination of losing our petroleum and gas inputs and having the climate change in our crop-producing areas is going to be a tremendous 1-2 punch for civilization and, you know, indeed for the undeveloped world, too. There are going to be regions of the world that can no longer support human life the way they have in the past. These are going to cause turbulent population movements as people flee and attempt desperately to get to other parts of the world that are doing better. And that also raises the direct implication of violence and you know, struggling over territory. So that is the main environmental thing we face. And, of course, you know, in America, we have to worry about how our grain-producing regions are going to be affected.
Hmm.
You know, we're already experiencing unprecedented droughts in certain parts of the country.
How long do you think the long emergency might be?
Frankly, I don't think that there's any horizon we can put on it, and especially because we tend to view these things within the context of our lifetimes or a generation or two or something that we can wrap our mind around. You know, it's possible that we will be in a historical period of hardship for decades or centuries. We don't know if we're going to figure out any other way of acquiring energy sources. We really don't know. There are some things that are promising, and many reasons to think that we may not get there. So, you know, all bets are off, really, about how long this is going to go on.
Yeah. Maybe we could just quickly sum up here. At the end of the book's second chapter, you write about a professor emeritus of geology at Princeton who thinks we're at or will soon be at peak production.
Yeah.
And then you in turn say, maybe what he's trying to tell us is this: let us give thanks for this extraordinary period of human history we lived through. Let us recognize we're moving into a new phase of history. Let's be brave and wise about it and prepare to move on.
Yeah, we have to make other arrangements, and we have to be brave about it. And historically, Americans have been brave and generous and honest and earnest and willing to sacrifice, and not necessarily just their lives, but their comfort and their convenience. And we're going to have to take these national qualities of character and try to restore them to what has become a surprisingly and shockingly kind of lazy public. You know, an American public who have been not challenged very much in the last two generations and not required to do much. We're going to have to change a lot. We're going to have to find new ways of living and find a new American dream. We can benefit a lot, I think, from the closer social and working relations that the future is going to require us to enter.
Jim Kunstler, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, it's a pleasure to be here.
James Howard Kunstler has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Long Emergency: Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. The book is published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. You'll find James Howard Kunstler on the web at kunstler.com, K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R. That's where we have to leave it. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. The sell-off at the Chicago Board of Trade continued today. Weather forecasts calling for cooler temperatures and prospects for improving rainfall coverage across Illinois, as well as the dollar break that we've already seen thus far this week. And then watching Tuesday's 668 low in the November soybean contract go by the wayside, as we saw settlement 666 and a quarter. All brings up possibilities that we might see a move toward the March-April lows. We'll be discussing that in just a few minutes with Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services in Bloomington, Illinois, on the closing market report that getting underway at 2:06. Let's go ahead and look at the settlements. July wheat, a high on the day of 327.5, a low of 319, settling 321.5, down 7. September, a high of 338.5, a low of 329, settling 331.5, down 7. December, a high of 351, a low of 341.5, settling 344, down 7. March, a high of 361.5, a low of 353.5, settling 355.75, down 7.25. July corn, a high of 214.75, a low of 209.5, settling 212.25, down 4.25. September, a high of 224.25, a low of 219, settling 222.25, down 3.75. December, a high of 235, a low of 229.5, settling 231.75, down 5.25. March, a high of 243, a low of 237.75, settling 240.5, down 4.5. May, a high of 247.5, a low of 242.5, settling 244, down 4.5. And July corn, a high of 250, a low of 245.25, make it 245.5, down, and then a settlement at 247.75, down 4.5 on the day. July oats, a high of 152, a low of 150, settling 151.25, down 1.25. September, a high of 158.25, a low of 156, settling at 156, down 2.25. And then those double-digit losses today in the soybean pit. July, a high on the day of 668, a low of 647, settling 651 and 3 quarters, down 20 and a quarter. August, a high of 672, a low of 651, settling 656, down 20 and a half. September, a high of 673, a low of 654, settling 658 and a half, down 20 and a half. November, a high of 682, a low of 660 and a half, settling 666 and a quarter, down 22 and three quarters. January, a high of 682, a low of 663, settling 667 and a half, down 24 and a half. March, a high of 674, a low of 656, settling 658 and a half, down 27. July soybean meal, a high of 208, a low of 202.50, settling 207, down 320. August, a high of 208.50, a low of 202.50, settling 207.30, down 330. July soybean oil, a high of 24.38, a low of 23.50, settling 23.61, down 93. August, a high of 24.30, a low of 23.50, settling at 23.81, down 80 on the day. Settlement prices also in over on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And Celeste, what was going on over there today?
I think it looks like it was a mixed day today, Dave, with feeder cattle mostly lower and lean hogs higher. Now let's take a look at the specifics. August feeder cattle, 109.90 the high, 109.10 the low. The settlement, 109.42 and a half, that up 7 and a half. September, 109.10 the high, the low 108.40 the low. The settlement, 108.70, that down 2 and a half. October, 107.65 the high, 107.12 and a half the low. The settlement, 107.47 and a half, that down 10. June live cattle finished 40 cents higher on the day. The high, 82.87 and a half. The low, 82.10. The settlement, 82.77 and a half. That up 40. August, 79.57 and a half. The high, 79 even. The low, the settlement, 79.30. That down 25. July lean hog, 66.05, the high, 65.25, the low, the settlement, 65.52 and a half, that up 40. August, 66 even, the high, 64.80, the low, 65.02 and a half, the settlement, that up 47 and a half. October, 57.05, the high, 55.85, the low, the settlement, 56.55, that up 75. December lean hogs, 54.90, the high, the low, 53.60, the settlement, 54.35, that up 72 and a half. July bellies, 59.30, the high, 56.30, the low, the settlement, 56.50, that down 140. The Dow is off 54 points at 10,321, the NASDAQ down 5 at 2063, the S&P 500 down 5.